We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer. Kyle Mabry is at the controls this morning. When you set out to learn a new language, you have to learn some new words. But there is more to learning a language than learning new words. It also involves learning to think in new ways about yourself, your place in the world, how you connect with other people. In this hour of Focus, our guest is Michelle Morano. She is Associate Professor of English at DePaul University. She's a writer, has written a lot of personal essays, including a collection that's titled Grammar Lessons, Translating a Life in Spain. And it is a book that's based on a year that she spent living in Spain. She went to teach English to university students there. And then also, when she was there, she was learning Spanish and working on her life at the same time. It's a nice book, really well written, published by the University of Iowa Press. You might head out to the bookstore and see if you can find a copy. She'll do a little reading from the book so you can get a sense of what it's about. She's visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. She's here sponsored by the Department of English, the Creative Writing Program, and she'll be doing a reading this afternoon, 4:30, in the Author's Corner of the Illini Union Bookstore. So if you're in and around Champaign-Urbana, you can stop by and see her and meet her and hear her read. Her essays have appeared in journals and anthologies, including Best American Essays 2006, the Georgia Review, the Missouri Review. She's won a number of awards for her writing. And as I said, she's Associate Professor of English at DePaul, and we're pleased that she could be here and spend some time talking with us. Questions are welcome. They're certainly possible. You'd like to call in, 333-9455. That's our number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. You can also send us an email if you want. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
I know that you are working on a novel, apparently.
Yes. I'm working on other things, too, that are stepping more into the foreground at the moment.
Well, I just say that just to make the point that you have and you do write fiction, but that most of your writing is personal essay, and that's what Grammar Lessons is. What is it about that form that you particularly like?
Well, I'm really interested in the stories that we accumulate in our lives that help us understand who we are, and interrogating a little bit the assumptions within those stories that we sometimes don't pay attention to. I've always been interested in the way, for example, that it's possible to revise our personal stories. And part of my living in Spain was about realizing that when you begin to tell your personal stories to other people, to new friends, for example, in a second language, you have to revise them. You simply cannot say things the way you always have said them in English. And so that process of revision led me to think, on the linguistic level, led me to think about how possible it is to revise the larger stories that we tell ourselves. So that's what I'm interested in as a writer, and I think also as a reader. In nonfiction particularly, I always want to know how, not just what happened, but how the author makes sense of what happened.
I'm really interested in this idea that I tried to set up here, that when you learn another language, that what you're learning is you learn how people do things in that language, so you learn different names for this for things, and you learn that maybe they like to put their words in a different order. You know, there are things like that, but that if you spend long enough with it and you try to get deeper into it, you see all of the ways that people think differently in different languages, and that's one of the things that you also are interested in writing about and do write about in Grammar Lessons.
Exactly. Yeah. One of the examples I use in the book is, you know, in English we say, if you drop something, you say, I dropped it, and the emphasis is on the I. And in Spanish you say, it fell from my hands. So there's no guilt there. You know, the thing fell.
Like
the book fell on the floor.
To do with it.
Exactly. There's just not, the eye is removed from that situation. And I mean, that's just such a tiny example. It's one of the things that trips up speakers of Spanish who are not native. But I always found that to be interesting, that in Spanish, there seems to be just less of a sense of blame, generally speaking, you know, and more of a sense of things happen and you just accept them and move on.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that you'll read for us here is one of the essays in the book that has to do with the something called the subjunctive mood.
Yeah.
And unless we have English majors listening, they're probably not sure what that is. I had to kind of look it up myself. And it's something that exists in English, but it's fading. People seem not to do it much anymore. But here, again, this is a very interesting difference between a language like English and one like Spanish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, I don't think English majors generally know the subjunctive at all. I think most people who encounter the subjunctive are people who are trying to learn Spanish or French or another language that has a subjunctive that's still very much in use. So in English, for example, the subjunctive is left over when we say, if I were going out tonight, I would do this. Whereas a lot of times now we just say, if I was going, but the if I were signals that it's not real, that it's a possibility, or it's a possibility that you're not going to choose, but it's not a definite thing. And it's really faded tremendously from English, but it's very much alive in Spanish. And so in Spanish, and anyone who's studying a foreign language that has a subjunctive and is a native English speaker is just driven mad by this, because you constantly have to be thinking, is this real or have I slipped into the possibility realm? But I think that's a larger kind of cultural difference as well, that in Spanish, and people aren't, as they're speaking every day, thinking, okay, now I've just slipped into the unreal. They're just using it reflexively the way we do most of our language in English. But I think underneath that is a deeper sense that there is this separate but kind of parallel world of what's possible but not definite.
Yeah. Well, this is very interesting. I guess I never hadn't really thought about that very much. Somehow I think I kind of got the subjunctive stuck in my head. So when I'm thinking about it, I think I get it right. And again, that's the sort of the difference between saying to somebody, I wouldn't do that. Say, I wouldn't do that if I was you.
Yes.
Which is what we would tend probably to say. But if you follow the right rule, what one should say is, I wouldn't do that if I were.
Exactly.
You. So there's a whole difference because, you know, I never was you and I can't be you.
Exactly.
It's entertaining the notion of, well, you know, in some kind of alternate universe, if I were you, I wouldn't do that. And that's a whole different way of thinking.
Mm-hmm. It is. And I think the if I were you, it sort of pays homage to the fact that I can't be, you know, a little bit more than the if I was you. But yeah, I just think that's a funny quirk of language. And I don't really understand why we've lost it in English.
It's, you know, how in English we often tend to, I think, say things, in speech at least, we say the things that seem the easiest. And to say, I wouldn't do that if I were you, something about that sounds wrong.
Yeah, because like I were is never a construction you would use. But if you switch it to the second person and you say, you know, I wouldn't do that. Well, it doesn't work there. But if you were me, what would you do?
You wouldn't say, if you was me.
Right, exactly. And so it's exactly the same. So I think maybe we lost it because it's not marked enough most of the time. Whereas in Spanish, if you say, if you were me, the verb changes completely. So it's a whole new set of verb conjugations that you have to learn as a non-native speaker. And then, you know, if you're like me, you get so obsessed with the subjunctive mood that you start saying everything in the subjunctive. And then no one can tell what you mean for sure and what you don't. You're trying to make plans with someone and they think it's all completely tentative.
Well, are you or aren't you?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Our guest here in this hour, Michelle Morano, she is Associate Professor of English at DePaul University, and she's here visiting the campus. She's going to give a reading, and maybe now, having talked about this, would be a good time for you to read a little bit from the essay in Grammar Lessons that deals with this whole business of the subjunctive.
Yeah, this is called In the Subjunctive Mood, and I'll just read the very first section. Think of it this way. Learning to use the subjunctive mood is like learning to drive a stick shift. It's like falling in love with a car that isn't new or sporty, but has a tilt steering wheel and a price you can afford. It's like being so in love with the possibilities, with the places you might go and the experiences you might have, that you pick up your new used car without quite knowing how to drive it, sputtering and stalling and rolling backward at every light. Then you drive the car each day for months until the stalling stops and you figure out how to downshift, until you can hear the engine's registers and move through them with grace. And later, after you've gained control over the driving and lost control over so much else, you sell the car and most of your possessions and move yourself to Spain, to a place where language and circumstance will help you understand the subjunctive. Remember that the subjunctive is a mood, not a tense. Verb tenses tell when something happens. Moods tell how true. It's easy to skim over moods in a new language, to translate the words and think you've understood, which is why your first months in Spain will lack nuance. But eventually, after enough conversations have passed, enough hours of talking with your students at the University of Oviedo, and your housemate Lola, and the friends you make when you wander the streets looking like a foreigner, you'll discover that you need the subjunctive in order to finish a question, or an answer, or a thought you couldn't have had without it. In language, as in life, moods are complicated, but at least in language, there are only two. The indicative mood is for knowledge, facts, absolutes, for describing what's real or definite. You'd use the indicative to say, for example, I was in love, or the man I loved tried to kill himself, or I moved to Spain because the man I loved, the man who tried to kill himself, was driving me insane. The indicative helps you tell what happened or is happening or will happen in the future when you believe you know for sure what the future will bring. The subjunctive mood, on the other hand, is uncertain. It helps you tell what could have been or might be or what you want but may not get. You'd use the subjunctive to say, I thought he'd improve without me. Or, I left so that he'd begin to take care of himself. Or later, after your perspective has been altered by time and distance and a couple of cervezas in a brightly lit bar, you might say, I deserted him, indicative. I left him alone with his crazy self for a year, indicative. Because I hoped, after which begins the subjunctive, that being apart might allow us to come together again.
That's Michelle Morano reading one of the essays, from one of the essays in her book, Grammar Lessons, Translating Life in Spain, and it's published by University of Iowa Press. She's on the campus. She'll be giving a reading this afternoon, 4:30, in the Author's Corner of the Illini Union Bookstore, so you can stop by. I think anybody who goes and lives in another country for a while starts, I'm sure, to examine the way that they think and ways that they wouldn't before if they'd never left home. Does this this whole business of the subjunctive, does that cause you to reflect on what I think is kind of an American tendency to think, well, we're saying it like it is, and maybe it's not always like it is, or that's a dodge saying?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I hadn't thought of it exactly like that. I mean, I think one of the things when you're confronting a new language, you're always focused on idioms, idiomatic expressions, things that can't be translated, mm-hmm. you know, all of the kind of cliches and the pat phrases, but also some of the really rich metaphors of language. And so when I was living in Spain, I made a friend, Yolanda, with whom I'm still very close today. And she and her boyfriend and I would get together about once a week for a language exchange. So we'd go out and drink a lot and spend half the night speaking in English and half the night speaking in Spanish, and our language ability always got a little better according to how much we drank. And so there I was very aware of, I remember once Yolanda saying to me, explain to me why New York is called the Big Apple. And I said, I just absolutely have no idea. I have absolutely no idea. And she kept asking, and finally I was saying, well, you know, why are you asking this question? Who cares? And it turns out that the word for apple tree in Spanish is the same as the word for, Yeah, it's the same as the word for block, like city block. And so she thought it had to do, you know, with some notion of city, there being a lot of city blocks, and also something about trees. Mm-hmm. And it turns out a friend of mine looked this up afterwards or found the information. It's the Big Apple actually refers to a brothel.
Indeed.
Yes, yes. And I think it was like an 18th century brothel, a very famous one that was called the Big Apple. And so New York took on this. And so this was very interesting to me. I'm not sure that we say it exactly like it is in English. I think we just have different ways of using metaphors. Mm.
Well, I guess my thought is that we think we say it like it is.
Yes.
But we don't.
No, that's absolutely true. We kind of value the straightforwardness. Although I will say this, the Spanish have no qualms about telling you exactly what they think. None at all. There's really a tremendous forthrightness about them. And I remember being in the presence of many times of people who were, I thought, about to come to blows, who were arguing about something. And it turns out it was just very good natured. A heated argument is not ever something that would lead to violence necessarily. The way in the U.S., I'm always expecting that if people are exchanging words and getting really loud, that, oh, no, there's the threat of violence behind it. But not in Spain. You're expected to defend your positions very strongly and then maybe change your mind and defend that position equally strongly. It's very interesting.
Mm-hmm. We have a caller here to talk with in Indiana. So let's do that on the toll-free line here, line 4. Hello.
Hello. Yeah. When you first mentioned the subjunctive mood, I started smiling like crazy. I think for a footnote, I think there's a relationship from the lack of the use of subjunctive could be correlated to the lack of teaching Latin in our high school. When I was in high school, for an academic science diploma, you had to take Latin, 2 years of it.
Right.
I found out, because I was one of those little smart asses, that people thought the subjunctive, people who never took Latin at least, was pretentious, and that there was a pressure not to use it. And if you did use it, you were just showing off because you learned something that nobody else really cared about. And, you know, why would you confuse the conversation with this highfalutin mood changes and things? And, of course, I latched onto that for several years, still do. So I find myself explaining to people at times, oftentimes in a library, why I said were instead of something else, like was. Mm-hmm. And when I was in high school, you would never have said if I was, because that would have been considered poor grammar, at least by the Latin teacher and the English teacher. That's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Well,
that's a great point, actually. I think you're absolutely right. And it also, two things. One is that I think it's terrible that we don't have to take Latin any longer. I never did, and I always wanted to. And actually, I tried, when I was in college, I tried to take Latin, and only two of us signed up, and the course got canceled. So I've always felt that as a real loss. But secondly, I do think there is this, here's something that is very American, and I think it goes back, to David, to your point about plain speech, that we value plain speech. I do think that as Americans in general, we're very skeptical of people who use big words, people who have, as the caller said, highfalutin vocabulary. You know, there's something about people don't like to be made to feel dumb. And I think that it's really unfortunate that we associate being articulate with the idea that someone feels, you know, superior in a way that rankles people. That's a real, I think that's tied to a real anti-intellectual sentiment in the U.S. that I think is unfortunate.
Well, other calls are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. My guest this morning, this hour, focus is Michelle Morano. Her book, Grammar Lessons, Translating a Life in Spain, based on a year that she spent in Spain teaching English and learning Spanish. And it's available here from the University of Iowa Press. So tell the story of why it is that you went to Spain.
Oh, this was the most random series of events. I had done an MA in literature at a small university in upstate New York, and I had just finished. And I was also working as a teaching assistant there. It was the very end of the term, and I walked into the English department to check my mail. And the chair of the department happened to see me and said, hey, what language do you speak besides English? And we had to have a second language. And I had studied Spanish in college enough to get the requirement waived, so I didn't have to take any Spanish classes in in the master's program, but I was very nervous suddenly because I thought he was going to break into Spanish and sort of test me. And then at the last minute, exactly, and at the last minute, I wouldn't get my degree. But in fact, I sort of tentatively said Spanish, and he said, "Oh, do you want to go to Spain for a year to teach?" And I said, "Yes." And then he fished out of his trash can a note that he had just gotten from the chair of the Spanish department. There was a teaching assistant exchange between this university and the University of Oviedo in Spain. And that particular year, there was no one in the Spanish department who could go. And so they had called over to English and said, "Do you have anybody?" And I was saying, "Well, but I technically I'm not a teaching assistant anymore because I'll have graduated." And they said, "Oh, we don't care about that." So I got to go instead. And it was just incredibly fortunate because it wasn't something that was on my radar at all. But the moment he asked the question, I just said yes. And I knew right then that I would go if they would have me.
Mm. Well, how good was your Spanish when you got there?
Not very. No, horrible. It was really horrible. In fact, you know, I could read well enough because that's what happens. You know, when you take Spanish in college and in high school, if you don't actually travel abroad, you really don't have that sense. And I had traveled abroad a little bit in college, enough to know that my Spanish wasn't very good at all. But you really don't have that sense of just absorbing the language in a way that becomes second nature at all. And so I was, my language was terrible. And I had this wonderful roommate, Lola, who was very, very patient with me. But I embarrassed myself daily, many, many times a day, by just not being able to say or saying something completely wrong. I remember her mother came to visit one day and I had a conversation with her. I was trying very hard. And I could see her mother just looking at me and then looking at Lola like, "This woman, I don't think she's all right. You know, I think there's something wrong with her." So, but it got better. It got much better by the end.
Well, they always say that if you go someplace and if you seem like you're making a sincere effort, that people appreciate that and they try to go the extra mile knowing that this is not your first language.
Exactly. And it was very fortunate for me that Lola spoke no English at all. And at the time that I got to Oviedo, I'm pretty sure I knew every other American in that small city, and there were four of us. So I just didn't speak English ever unless I was teaching. Mm-hmm. And that was very, very fortunate. It was truly an immersion. Oh, well, and also with Yolanda when I was drinking.
Well, when you read a little bit of the essay about subjunctive mood, you said that, say, for people who are native English speakers, if that's your first language, when they're trying to learn Spanish or French, for example, this is the thing that they find really difficult. Was there something in particular that your students who were Spanish speakers who were trying to learn English found difficult about English?
Yes, and it's actually almost an exact correlation to the subjunctive. It was the conditional, the past conditional tense. So if you said, say, "If I had gone, I would have gotten home at this time." And that drove them absolutely crazy. And the way I learned subjunctive, ultimately, to the extent that I did learn it, which was not complete, was by going back and forth with them, translating between Spanish and English. So it was like doing algebra almost. I mean, I'd be on the board and we'd be putting all the verbs up and trying to figure out, okay, how do you know when you use this one versus that one? And that was tremendously helpful to me, but it was a thing they struggled with most.
So did you write these essays as you were living this? No, it was
not
it,
at
it was,
all.
It was,
no.
was later that you wrote?
It was much later. I mean, when I was, you know, when I lived in Spain, I had hopes of being a writer one day, but I didn't take myself seriously as a writer. So I took a lot of notes and a lot of photographs and saved a lot of maps and ticket stubs and all of that. And then later when I was in graduate school, I actually started graduate school at the University of Iowa as a medievalist. And so completely different field. And while I was there, they had a great nonfiction program, but it was an MA in writing. And I already had an MA and thought, well, I don't need another one of those. But while I was there, they converted it to an MFA. I thought, well, that I don't have yet. I was working on a PhD. I had all these other degrees. So I started taking classes in that program and was just so enamored of it and had such great support from my professors that I ended up doing the MFA in nonfiction and a PhD with a creative dissertation. So some of these essays I wrote in the first time as part of my dissertation. And that was, you know, 10 years after I had lived in Spain. Not quite, but, you know, maybe about 7 or 8 years when I first started them. And so I'd had a lot of time to reflect and let things settle Some people write really marvelously while they travel, but I can't do it. I really have to let things percolate and, you know, let my subconscious decide what's going to end up staying with me.
Hmm. Let's talk with somebody else. The Hoosiers are all coming out here. This is Lafayette and line four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I think perhaps you've skipped with the subjunctive the conditional sense that follows the sentence, and in fact our habit of double, what I'll call double conditionals. If I would have left earlier, I would have seen this or that.
You know, that's a construction that I'm unsure of. If I would have left earlier, is that grammatically correct? Because
it doesn't sound very good, but it's very common.
It is very common, but I think that the correct phrase is "if I had left."
Yes, it is. The conjunction follow the subjunctive, followed by the conditional clause.
Right, right. And I see this in my student work all the time. If I would have done something, and I'm forever crossing it out and writing "if I had," because I think it's. It's not just a grammatical issue like a textbook rule for me. It's one of, I think it's very confusing. If I would have, I don't know as a reader how to understand that phrase.
Well, that's two of us. The other thing I wanted to mention, if we could get back to the business of thinking differently necessarily and learning a new language. I'm thinking of the long German sentences celebrated. With a verb completed eight lines later, so you have to hold that meaning in suspension while you labor through the rest.
Right. Yes. Mark Twain has a famous quote about that. He said, the Germans begin a sentence and then dive into the Atlantic and swim across and come up on the other side with the end of the verb in their mouths.
But during that swim... During that long swim, a person must suspend the thought, which is to come with a verb, completed at the end.
Right.
So they must have to have a different way of thinking, of suspending, and of perhaps anticipating what will be the verb at the end.
I think that's true. I took 1 year of college German, and those long sentences did me in. So I don't remember exactly the grammatical underpinnings of that, but it has something to do with the way the verb is conjugated. I do think it's not with verbs, but we do a similar thing in English with periodic sentences. So you begin a sentence, and then there's a long pause before you end it. So, for example, if I say... on the train yesterday, I saw, and by the way, I'm not telling you this so that you feel sorry for me. And then, you know, comma, and then you finish the sentence. So I think we do have a way in English of holding things in our mind and understanding that we're going to come back to the sentence, but we don't do it with a divided verb.
But in my pursuit of German, I find myself more and more anticipating what the verb might be at the end of a sentence from the general direction of the part in the middle.
Right, right. Well, I wonder if that correlates to some sort of cultural patience.
Mm-hmm.
It may very well.
I'll let you struggle with that.
All right, thank you for the call. This is Focus. I'm David Inge, and we'll have more with writer Michelle Morano after a short break. This is Focus.
As we wind up our look at 150 years of City of Champaign history, Illinois Pioneers takes a look at the industries that have helped transform and grow our community. From forges to food, transportation to technology, and agriculture to aviation, the industrial history of Champaign is a fascinating snapshot of the country in general. Next time on Illinois Pioneers.
7:30 Thursday night on WILL-TV.
WILL programming is made possible by Columbia Street Roastery, offering over 30 varieties and blends of whole bean or ground coffee at 24 East Columbia in Champaign. Coffee, tea, and chai are available from their retail store, in local restaurants, and through Columbia Street Roastery's coffee service. More information is available at 352-9713.
This is Focus. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics for you every week. Tomorrow morning in the 11 o'clock hour, our guest is journalist Edward Dolnick. We'll talk some about the life and work of Isaac Newton, subject of his new book, The Clockwork Universe. And then on Wednesday at 11, our guest will be syndicated columnist Leonard Pitts. We'll talk about American politics. You can see the schedule for the entire week and listen to past programs by going to our website. That's Will, W-I-L-L. Illinois.edu. In this hour of Focus, my guest is Michelle Morano. She's Associate Professor of English at DePaul University. She has been talking some about the essays that you will find in her book, Grammar Lessons, Translating a Life in Spain. It's published by the University of Iowa Press. I wasn't really thinking that we'd be doing so much grammar lessons but on the program, but so you can read the book, and she's here visiting the campus. Visit here sponsored by the Department of English, the Creative Writing Program, and she'll be giving a reading on the campus this afternoon, 4:30, in the Author's Corner of the Illini Union Bookstore. Something that I was interested in having you talk about in connection with writing personal essays. Memoir seems to be now a very popular, important form of writing, and there are lots and lots of them. But it also seems that on a fairly regular basis, we get stories about someone who has written a very popular and successful memoir, and it turns out that it wasn't true. And just now, for example, there's a lot of controversy surrounding Greg Mortensen, mm-hmm. who wrote this book, Three Cups of Tea, where he told the story about mountain climbing in Pakistan, trying to climb K2, which is the second highest mountain in the world. And so he talks about how he didn't make it to the top. He's exhausted. He's lost. He stumbles into this village in Pakistan. The people are very nice there. They take care of him. And in return, he says, I'm going to build you a school. And he's turned this into a big project where he has built schools in Pakistan. And he's this very successful author. And now it turns out apparently it's not quite like that. Mm-hmm. What do you make of this? It's not that specific example, but, you know, the fact that memoir is really big, but fairly regularly here we're hearing stories about people who made stuff up, but they're offering it as if this is what happened.
Right. Well, this is a complicated issue, I think, and it's one that I face as not just as a writer, but as a teacher of writing, because this issue comes up all the time in my classes where students are very nervous about whether they're fabricating something, how far can they go to use their imaginations to fill in details that they don't exactly remember. And this past week, the author Steve Almond had a really lovely little piece in on the Rumpus website where he took this issue on. And at one point he said that good creative nonfiction is a highly subjective account of something that actually happened. And so I think we would all agree that highly subjective means that maybe you have had to add in some details or use your imagination to create what the reader needs, which is slightly different from exactly what you remember. But it does not include claiming that you've been kidnapped by the Taliban when you haven't, or claiming that you've spent 87 days in jail, as James Fry did, without ever having gone to jail overnight at all. So I think there's a distinction to be made between the memoirs that are just wholesale made up. Every now and again, there's a Holocaust memoir that pops up and it's, you know, filled with cliches, but wonderfully written, and everyone is enamored of it until it turns out that that person was never associated with the Holocaust. That's one kind of, I think, pathology that goes into writing that kind of an account. Then there's the memoir, like the one you're referring to by Greg Mortensen, that has, a primarily true story at its base, but then it gets embellished in ways that kind of push it over the top. And I think that's really a failure on the part of authors to trust their own stories. What I learned in graduate school in an MFA program in nonfiction, what I take to heart, is that your subject is important, of course, but in the end it matters less than the way you talk about your subject. And so, where I think James Fry went wrong, and I think he understood this afterwards, is that he had a great story and he didn't need to turn it into something that was over the top, kind of crazy. It was a good story to begin with. And I don't know if that's exactly the same with Greg Mortensen, because I'm not I haven't really, I almost couldn't bear to keep up with this one, so I haven't looked really closely at the parts that were fabricated. But I think that, you know, generally speaking, you have to trust your story. And that's what I tell my students. And, you know, I always tell my students, at the point where you make something up, where you step away completely from reality, and I've had this experience with myself as a writer, that's the point at which your piece is going to start to suffer. That it's about ethics to some degree, but also in my experience, it's about I throw myself off when I suddenly go, okay, well, this didn't exactly happen in that place, but it would be so much more convenient if it had. So let me just put it there. And at that moment, things start to go awry in the writing. So I just think that there's kind of an artistic value to sticking with your story. And then, you know, to using all kinds of, I mean, it's fine to use imagination and to play around with reality and unreality, but you need to signal that to the reader when it's happening, by and large, I think.
One of the things that I remember about Fry, at least this is how I remember it, reading about it afterwards, all the controversy, was that he said he started out writing that book as a novel.
Yes.
And was pitching it as a novel, and that someone, whether it was agent, publisher, somebody said to him, you know, this would be a whole lot better if we could sell this as a memoir.
Right. Well, I think that's a really, I agree. Something went wrong there, and he is, you know, he's ultimately to blame because his name is on the front cover of the book, but I don't think he was not alone in that. And I think that's a really sad commentary on the state of literature right now, that a book that could not sell as a novel because it was completely implausible and over the top, then sold very quickly as a memoir. And I just think that's really sad, you know, and Oprah picked it up and, I mean, was of course furious when she found out that he had not just embellished, he had flat out lied about events in that book. And she was, I think she must have been embarrassed more than anything, because she had thrown herself behind this book despite the fact that multiple people had called her production offices and said, look, this just simply isn't true. And they had ignored all that because there's something so enticing about not just a story that is real, but the story that we want to hear told. We want to know that an addict, through sheer willpower, can overcome his addiction. Mm-hmm. And that, so I think the desire to believe it was stronger than, you know, the healthy skepticism that could have and should have been aroused.
So that's, so you answered the question that was in my mind, the question being, why is it that it's better that that's, one can say, whether you're publisher, writer, whatever, that you can say this is a true story, why is it better than that being a novel? And perhaps the answer is because we'd like those kinds of stories where there's redemption.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And it feels better to us if we think that that's real, that it's a real story, real person, real experiences. And they, as you say, they came through all this really horrible stuff and lived to tell the tale.
Right. And, you know, I want to have it both ways on this, because I have a friend who was in Morocco for a year and a half on a Fulbright. And while she was there, she was doing some research for a writing project that's kind of a travel project and it's a memory project. And people that she met in Morocco kept saying to her, oh, here's a book that you must read. This is a really wonderful book and it'll help you think about what you're doing. And she would constantly say, is it fiction or nonfiction? And they would say, oh, what does that matter? It's good. Just read it. And so I think there is this American obsession that we have with the truth and with verifiable truth. And we don't. So I think that's a little bit of a problem, that we have that obsession, that we're so intent on everything being, you know, either fiction or nonfiction. At the same time, I think there's a difference, you know, so I just believe in both things. I believe on the one hand that it doesn't matter that a good piece of literature defies categorization. On the other hand, as a writer, I think differently when I'm writing a piece of nonfiction versus when I'm writing a piece of fiction. So I don't know how to reconcile those two, that contradiction.
About 10 minutes left with Michelle Morano. She's associate professor of English at DePaul University. So she's a teacher and is also a writer, writes a lot of personal essays. And if you'd like to read some of her work, you can look for her book, Grammar Lessons, about her experiences living in Spain when she was teaching English and learning Spanish. And she'll be on the campus. She is on the campus. We'll be doing a reading this afternoon at the Illini Union Bookstore. I want to come back to, because I'd mentioned right at the beginning that I had read that you have in some shape or form have a novel underway, and wanted to have you talk a little bit about the differences here between fiction and the personal essay, and so maybe then about what interests you about the possibility of writing a novel that is clearly purely fiction.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. Once I finished this book, I went away. The book was, you know, in production, and I went away to an artist colony, a really wonderful artist colony, for a month. And while I was there, I was just kind of casting about, thinking about my next project and working on an essay. And I did what many writers do after they put out a full-length book of creative nonfiction. I sort of leaned immediately into the arena of fiction, because it was so different, and I wanted a break, and I wanted to play a little bit more. Because the other thing about writing personal essays is that the stories are based in real life, and they're often emotional or have some degree of, you know, great humor, but also some pain in them. And so I just wanted to move away and write something that wasn't drawn specifically from my life. So I got going on this novel project, which I'm still very interested in, and I take it out now and again and play with it. And I'm definitely going to return to it. But the truth is, I don't know how to write a novel. Writing a first novel is very difficult, because you have to teach yourself how to do it. I mean, even if you're in a creative writing program, you still have to teach yourself what you need to, you know, create the architecture of that long single story. Well, multiple stories, but long single overarching story. And so I'm still in the process of figuring that out. And in the meantime, I've gone back to writing essays, because I've had enough time. I had enough time away from the forum to get really excited again about new stories that I want to tell, and also just ideas that I want to explore. So I'm kind of doing both at the moment. You know, yeah. I dip in a little bit to the fiction, and then I come back to the nonfiction, and I feel like it. The two different genres exercise my brain in really different ways that are nicely compatible.
Well, I want to hear about how it is you got this idea that you wanted to write a novel about a girl who works in a fireworks factory.
Right. Well, okay, so it's not entirely not autobiographical. I worked in a fireworks factory.
Oh, okay.
I did, yeah. For on and off for quite a while, for about 2 or 3 years, when I was just out of college. And it was fabulous. It was a wonderful experience. It's something I'm really glad to have done, but it was kind of harrowing at the time, you know.
I would think.
I mean, I worked for a very small company, and they were wonderful people, and very safety conscious. So, but we did have to do things like, you know, spray ourselves down head to toe with Static Guard before touching some of the powders that went into the bombs. You know, and they really are called bombs. And so I had one period where I was working for them full time for a few months, and I had just a tremendous number of dreams that things were blowing up all around me. So it was and it's wonderfully metaphoric. And so I really want to pursue that. And I have a whole story. I have the whole thing mapped out. It's just a matter of, I'm having a little trouble with the narrator, actually, because since it is my experience, I'm just still working on crafting her in such a way that she isn't just a younger version of myself. But it's really fun to play with.
Yeah. I like the potential setup there. How did you, were you looking for work and just
no.
In the newspaper there was an ad that wanted someone to work in fireworks factory? How did you get that job?
No, I dated a guy who lived in a house that was located on the property of the fireworks company. It was this big, like sprawling, you know, many acred plot of land. And there were two houses on the property, and he was renting one. So he had gotten involved in, you know, it's fireworks in your backyard. How can you not wander over and see if they need any help? And so I kind of got involved through him. And then, and I have to say, I have just nothing but fond memories of that period, despite the harrowing dreams. It was really fun and exciting.
Well, I guess it's a very complicated business, designing fireworks and having getting them not only to go up there to launch to do what you want, but to be really beautiful. And I'm sure if you're in that business, maybe also you like to think every once in a while that you're going to invent something that nobody has done before.
It's true. And they had, the guys I worked for, invented new colors. They had purple stars before anybody else had purple. They made them themselves there on the property. And so, and they also use, you know, now a lot of the fireworks that you see are from China, and they're made in sort of a very simple way. And we at the time started making them in that way as well, because it's so much safer and faster. But these guys also still use the old Italian hand-rolled cardboard cylinders that are rolled in paper, soaked in paste, and then tied with string, and it's very laborious, but they're absolutely beautiful. So they actually still do that.
Yeah. So now if you go and you see fireworks, do you think to yourself, oh, that's not very good?
No, oh, I never think it's not very good, but I do identify the shells. No one can ever watch a firework. I mean, this is so long ago. You know, it's been 20 years since I did this work. Okay. Well, not quite, but I still, whenever I see them, I'm thinking about the people on the ground. As much as what's up in the sky.
And do you still have dreams about things blowing up?
I don't, but I might after this conversation.
All right. Just one story that I read about you, I really liked it, and I wanted to ask you about it, was when you were in the eighth grade. There was a story about how you were, the class was having to write reports about careers.
Yes.
And that there was a box that had different careers that you had to pick from. And by the time you got round to it, there were only two things left, physical therapist and writer. And it was an interview that I read where you said that before that, the idea of being a writer as a career just hadn't really occurred to you.
Exactly. And actually, what actually happened was that there were two careers left and writer was not there. It was physical therapist and something else. And I took physical therapist and I researched it. And then I just thought, oh, okay, you know, I don't know. And so I went back up, you know, the next day to see what the other thing was in the box. And somebody had brought back writer and taken the whatever else it had been in the box. So then it was just writer in the box. And that was the moment where I thought you could do that. You know, you could be a writer. It had never occurred to me.
That's an even better story.
Yeah. Yeah. So
it's much more serendipitous
right. That
way, because you took the thing and you thought, well, I don't really want to do this. And then you decided I can't do this. And you went back and there was no choice.
Exactly.
That was that.
Well, I could have still chosen physical therapist, but no, it was just such a relief to see. And I remember it just being such a thrill to see that word and think, wow, and I just thought immediately, that's what I'm going to be.
Had you been doing writing at that point?
You know, I had, you know, done all the school assignments and gotten, you know, a lot of praise, even in elementary school. But let me tell you, I was so far from being a writer in any way, shape, or form. You know, I wasn't a precocious kid who was writing lots of stories on my own or any of that. I mean, it took decades before I actually felt that I could truly claim that label for myself.
Was there a particular moment that stands out as being the moment where you really thought, you said to yourself, now I think I'm in one sense, I'm there, not like you're ever there, but
yeah,
that you're there.
Well, I think it was the moment when I realized that I would stop being a medievalist and I would pursue a creative dissertation. And, you know, then I just thought, no, that's it. I'm a writer. You know, I had been writing seriously for a while then and taking courses, but that was still my secondary identity. And at that moment, I thought, wow, I'm actually going to do what I always wanted to do.
Well, we have a couple minutes. I know that you said you could read a little bit more for people who weren't with us for the first half of the show, and they'll have a chance to hear you read a little bit more.
Yeah, I'll just read the opening of one other essay in the book because I think it gives a flavor for, that flavor is a bad pun, but a flavor for what the book tries to capture in terms of my sensory experiences in Spain. So this is an essay called The Quemada. And later, after the mussels, after the pulpo a la gallega, the swirling bits of octopus flesh in a sauce of garlic and tomatoes, after the glasses of wine and loaves of bread broken and passed hand to hand, after the strong local blue cheese spread thick on thin crackers and the apples drizzled with honey, after we have all eaten as much as we can and then placed the remains from one another's plates, I'm sorry, after we have all eaten as much as we can and then picked the remains from one another's plates, tucking into our mouths one more time, one more spoonful, one more tangy or sweet or salty fingertip, then we turn, lights dimmed and candles aflame, to the quemada.
That's nice. Makes me hungry. I'm already hungry, getting pretty close to lunchtime. You said a couple of minutes ago that, you know, you were... You like the idea of writing fiction because it was a kind of a break.
Yeah.
But then you got to the point where, well, you said also, but there were some things that some other things that you wanted to write about, other stories maybe that you wanted to tell. You wanted to go back to writing essays. What stories are you itching to tell?
Well, right now I'm working on, I have a couple things going. One is a series of essays about the topic of non-physical romantic love. Because I've just in reflecting on some of my experiences, it has occurred to me that some of the most romantic moments of my life did not involve what we would normally think of as romance. In other words, very romantic moments that there wasn't a person involved with whom I was going to be in an actual relationship. Mm-hmm. So I've been writing some of those. And then I also have some essays. I had a baby 3 years ago. And when he was 4.5 months old, we moved to Spain for 3 months. I was leading a study abroad program. And so I have a couple pieces I'm working on about that sort of transition period into becoming a parent, but also traveling with a baby, which was a completely different way to see Spain and to be in Spain. And so I'm working a little bit on those. Mm. Yeah.
Well, we're just about the point here where we have to finish up. For people who would like to hear more from Michelle Morano, she's going to do a reading and book signing this afternoon at 4:30 in the Author's Corner of the Illini Union Bookstore on the campus. So anybody's interested can stop by. If you'd like to find out more about her, otherwise you can go to her website, which is michellemorano.com. And you also might look for her book, Grammar Lessons, Translating a Life in Spain. It's published by University of Iowa Press. Michelle is Associate Professor of English at DePaul University. She's here visiting, sponsored by the Department of English, the Creative Writing Program. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you so much.